this week. Lackluster employment numbers sent money flows away from the stock market into the yellow metal and silver. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you for another big show this weekend. Wall Street wizard Peter Granditz joins me. He says that quantitative easing from our central bank, well, it arguably saved the banking system from collapse, but it might not provide the long-term stimulus expected by Fed officials. The Fed was forced to shoulder the stimulus burden typically shared by Congress through fiscal policies. The result could be a lost generation as living standards continue to erode well below those enjoyed by our parents, culminating with an even deeper financial crisis. After the current consolidation in the precious metals market passes, Peter expects gold to ascend to $1,400 later this spring. Plus, food shortages and rationing are occurring in Venezuela. Some analysts are concerned that it could spread around the globe, even reaching the U.S. Perhaps it's time to start stockpiling necessities. And you won't want to miss Robert Ehans as he wraps up the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather report. Mostly sunny weather appeared over the precious metals exchanges this week as investors turned away from overpriced equities in favor of the safe haven of the precious metals market. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, the yellow metal added just shy of $10, finishing at $13.02 for the week. It's still higher for the year by 5%, due in part to lackluster economic growth and the recent annexation of Crimea by Russia, which could lead to a new Cold War, according to the London Telegraph. Silver added about 10 cents, finishing just shy of $20. Palladium gained $15, closing near $7.90. Russia remains the top global producer. Some folks are accumulating palladium in anticipation of reduced exports to the West. And platinum gained $15, finishing at $14.48 an ounce on continued trouble in South Africa as miner strikes are limiting production. The nation supplies nearly half of global platinum output. More than 70,000 members of the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union have been on strike since January 23rd in South Africa. They issued a memo this week noting that supply contracts, some of them will not be at least fulfilled due to the strike. And West Texas Intermediate crude dropped about half a dollar, still finishing well above the century mark at $101 per barrel, remaining strong from a technical vantage point. Well, the top story influencing the precious metals market this week was news from the Labor Department, which showed the U.S. job growth was less than anticipated. March non-farm payrolls increased by about 192,000 versus the anticipated 200,000 number. Both January and February payrolls were revised higher nonetheless. The national unemployment rate remained static at 6.7%, worse than expected. Economists were hoping for 6.6%. Last week, Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen noted that the economy will require monetary stimulus for some time, suggesting that the Fed governors must increase efforts to reduce national unemployment. With U.S. job growth lower than anticipated, the Federal Open Market Committee may curtail tapering of quantitative easing. Investors regained interest in the precious metal safe haven, expecting the Fed to hold rates low, perhaps well into next year and beyond. Demand from China for gold is expected to increase. Analysts are calling for government economic stimulus programs to boost demand for the yellow metal as a safeguard against the threat of lost purchasing power. China is the world's top gold consumer, followed by India. However, it's widely anticipated that import curbs will soon be lifted, causing an influx of gold imports back into India, putting the nation in the position of top global importer of the yellow metal once again. India's bullion imports increased over 100% last month alone. Bottom line for the precious metals. Well, the new Fed chair appears to be switching from wildly hawkish to somewhat dovish, and the commodities market picked up on this lack of decisiveness, posting one of the most bullish closes in weeks with clear signs of accumulation. The metals advanced despite dollar strength. The technical situation remains constructive. Gold, silver, and related equities did find support, and time will tell if these current levels hold. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, mostly cloudy skies hovered over the New York Stock Exchange this week. In the wake of the disappointing national employment numbers, without robust jobs growth, The all-important consumer spending figure is likely to sag, comprising nearly 3/4 of national output and, of course, significantly impacting corporate profits. Investors chose to lock in gains in anticipation of bargain opportunities in the coming weeks. The Dow Jones added 89 points for the week, ending at 16,412. The S&P 500 added about 7, finishing at 1865, while the NASDAQ reaction continued, dropping 28 points, ending at 4127. Investors rotated out of growth stocks and into value plays this week as the markets were primed for perfection but received lackluster economic reports instead. 9 out of 10 of the S&P 500 sectors declined on Friday, 6 of them by more than 1%. But the precious metals sector actually held up quite well this week. One of my favorite stocks, Randgold, ticker G-O-L-D, added nearly 1.5% for the week with signs of accumulation in the charts, as well as for many of its rival firms. In more positive equities news, the IPO market remains robust, a positive sign for the bulls. IMS Health Holdings rose on its opening day initial public offering. The company raised about $1.3 billion, registering as the second biggest IPO of the year. Shares gained about 15% on the first day, bottom line on Wall Street. Well, although fear is returning to the 7-component sentiment index, the pendulum has not quite yet swung fully to the other extreme, so it might be a bit early to call a bottom here. And for all of next week's stock candidates and market forecasts, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Peter Grandich and Robert Ian. We'd like for you to stay with us here at GoldSeek. Joining me to discuss the precious metals markets today, market analyst Peter Grandich. He's a commentator for MoneyTalks.net. Welcome, Peter Grandich.
Good to be back with you.
I wonder if we could start off with a news event I came across today. It's really off topic a bit, but maybe it's not so far off topic after all, that folks in Venezuela are now being required to, well, essentially provide their fingerprints in order to buy groceries. But it just seems to me like what a mess this nation would be in if actually outlawed any type of stockpiling of food whatsoever. In fact, you're considered a criminal of the state if you have virtually anything other than what's in a couple of pantry shelves worth of food. But it seems as though we might see something like that if inflation gets out of control in the United States. Any thoughts?
100% candid, and if my daughter's life was dependent on it, if you would have asked me that question before this administration started, I would have told you not a chance in the world. But since this administration, 6 years, I don't put anything past something like that happening here. There's been such a radical change towards socialism and government controlling things that I don't consider that impossible. I still think it'd be improbable, because I don't think we're anything remotely close to the state of economics in Venezuela right now. But I would tell you that I would no longer say near impossible.
There are some contingency plans people can make. You know, I know there's probably people listening out there thinking, well, just what can I really do? Because those MREs, maybe folks aren't interested in, they don't maybe like the taste, too expensive, too costly. Canned foods, well, you know, cans degrade over time, not to mention the contents, although in reality, anything that's undented, I've heard, can last 5 to 10 years and even longer. There is one alternative here that I've come across just personally. I'd like to throw this out there for the listeners. A Latter-day Saints website will send you a package of 6 different sealed cans, and the contents of everything from beans, rice, grains lasts 20 to 30 years, actually. This is something that could be stored maybe in sealed Tupperware containers under one's property or whatnot. It'd give you the peace of mind that if any weird regulations came into place or severe weather calamities like we saw on the East Coast, not to mention Katrina, you would have some type of backup plan. Just wanted to toss that out to the folks. They deliver it right to your home. It's just something that we like. Back on track here, and I wanted to begin the dialogue with the precious metals. We've seen a little sell-off here after a very robust beginning of what looked like a recovery rally in 2014. We saw the metals, gold up over 10, 12, 13% at one point. We've pulled back sharply, and now we're starting to see some signs of accumulation.
Well, I too felt just a few weeks ago that we had an earnest a renewal of the uptrend that began, you know, almost 13 years ago. It really seemed to earmark, although I had spoken that 1,400 would be a more than just a milestone to get back over, and we would have to probably trade under it somewhat. But I really felt that we were going higher. And, of course, instead we've seen an almost $100 retreat back. And I retreat is probably not the right word, because I think punishment back, because the type of trading, again, seemed to be of some out of normal profit taking or just general selling. And it's disappointing. I certainly was wrong in the belief that we were about to break out above 1400 in this month. But I think it also can be argued away, even if we don't want to talk about manipulation and hidden powers, on the belief that the stock market was continuing to go higher. Yellen just opened the door again, that the Fed is going to do whatever it can to keep the financial markets up, and that probably took some steam out of the gold market, and also was just somewhat of a cycle/seasonal period where it tended to be some weakness as well. So disappointing, but certainly not anything to make me feel that we're going back and going to retest lows that we saw last year. I don't think that's in the cards. We need to get past this employment number. We all know, and it's kind of makes you puke if you're in the gold market, that it almost seems like a 90% of the time that around the employment number, gold gets hit either the day before, during, or right after. But I think if we can get through it and get back above 1,300, I think we'll start marching back towards that 1,400 as we get into spring.
Any anticipation, any thoughts at all on the employment number?
Well, where I stand is this. I have written extensively in recent weeks about a gentleman that I have urged my readers to follow. He's an independent financial journalist. Although he works in the mainstream media, he's anything but like the puppets and the Muppets that we see in financial journalism. His name is John Credell. He's been an investigator, reporter, and lead business writer for the New York Post for decades. And he's been writing a series. In fact, it's because of his work that there is no fewer than five investigations in the House and Senate right now over the Department of Labor and its recording of employment numbers. First, that started out at the Philadelphia branch and now has expanded to other areas around the country. And in his most recent articles, he highly suspects that what they will find is that there was gross negligence past just one office in terms of fluffing the numbers. But whether the numbers were fluffed or not, they accomplished what they wanted to accomplish. And it's ironic, but he says in his latest column, while we may escape this month of not having an above average number, for the months of when April's come out in May and June and July, is when the Department of Labor does a tremendous amount of seasonal adjustments. They actually create a model, this death-birth model, that actually creates that all sorts of people somehow got jobs even though they don't really exist. So I'm still worried that the bias to these numbers is to the upside, that they are being manipulated, and that will be what the Wall Street would want in order to continue this market going forward. So I like to get past the number tomorrow, and because they won't be able to use the weather if it's a bad number, but I suspect that they'll do everything they can to put a halfway decent number out.
The reason why the markets are so focused on this unemployment number is that it is a major component in the Fed's recipe for low rates and stimulus. If more folks are working, according to this, let's call it official number, they don't need as much stimulus, and maybe they can take their foot off of the Fed's overnight rates and the discount rate and let it rise a bit. That, of course, would put incredible pressure on the commodities market. I'm sure you've noticed that the general commodities market had a substantial recovery in 2014 so far, at least, and we're consolidating there. It looks like we could continue this move higher as the precious metals are highly correlated with the CRB index. Any thoughts?
Well, I think where we're going to see strength in commodities, inflation-leading indexes, will be from what we get out of foods. There's no question that the food or soft grain markets and things of those type are going to work their way higher. There's just a tremendous shortage out there. I still, you know, believe that, like other numbers, just like the Bureau of Labor Statistics has played around with the employment numbers, the inflation numbers are played with, because I still don't see in my household things just going up 1 or 2 tenths a month, percent a month. It just seems that things go up a lot higher, even though the government tells us otherwise. But I also think that gold is, and people purchasing gold are not buying it from a fear of inflation. I think people who have been big buyers of gold in the Far East one era are buying it as an alternative to paper currency. That's what I think is the single biggest driver, and that's why we don't see an overwhelming demand here in the U.S., because people have been falsely on a security basis that somehow their currency is still relatively strong, which it isn't. But I think people outside of North America recognize that, and that the inevitability is that the U.S. dollar will not be the reserve currency. So rather than put things in dollar-denominated assets, that's why they have a streaming of gold, even though they may be purchasing it in dollars. They believe the gold price itself can only go higher, and so they're not going to have the paper losses that they think eventually going to come from stocks and bonds and U.S. currencies.
Well, your inflation comments, particularly with regard to the Grandage household, you know, what you're actually seeing when you go to the store, when you pick up that bag of pasta, when you fill the grocery cart, we're noticing several alarming trends there. Firstly, smaller portion. Take an item purchased, let's say, sitting in the pantry in 2011, 2012 sizes are getting smaller. Box sizes stay the same. The portions are becoming smaller. A serving size, as though we're shrinking as human beings. Unfortunately, that's not the case. That's only, I think, a small component of the issue here. A bigger piece of the puzzle, household income, disposable household income, has collapsed as a middle class. Go back to, let's say, the 1970s. The typical income, household income right now, is similar in size. It was somewhere around 35,000 in 1978, 1979. Fast forward to today, the typical income has dropped to $35,000 because we have much higher prices, greater costs, everything from gasoline, home heating, groceries, insurance, tuition. Now, when you have a simple garage sale, not only did you have to pay an income tax and several other taxes just to purchase the items, now you're being double and triple taxed on everything you sell in your garage sale. You bring it all together, and it is a wholesale wipeout of the middle class. And I don't want to get on a political soapbox here, so I'll step off. It does tie together with your inflation theme, that what they really need to do, if they want to give us an accurate inflation figure, I think they need to bring in a deflator of the lost disposable purchasing power or income of the typical median American household. But that's just my personal opinion. I also found it interesting that the U.S. dollar, and we, you know, we've talked about this on previous shows, the U.S. dollar has had virtually every opportunity in the world to move sharply higher during this precious metals, let's call it reaction, in the last two or so years. But it just hasn't been able to pick up any steam, no momentum. Now, I can think of several reasons, but I think two of the top ones that come to mind, that Russia is talking about moving away into its own realm, away from any type of dollar-denominated transactions. Of course, China has been on that path for several years now, and you see the petrodollar, essentially that arrangement collapsing worldwide.
I think it's that, and if you think about it, that the U.S. has certainly been in this tapering mode. One would have thought, since they were in a tapering mode and many other countries were going in the opposite direction, that the dollar would really separate dramatically from those currencies. And it's basically just held, it's like treading water. And so there's clearly a belief that, A, as you said, the movement away from the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency continues. Again, I also just think it's people are looking in certain areas of the world, particularly in Asia and China, to de-emphasize U.S. assets in general. Yes, because the Fed has created so much money here that it's made up for it. Let's not forget that at times there was as much as 80 or 90% of the bond purchases, and you wonder that if they do taper and go to zero, who makes up that difference? And that's probably an argument for later this year and into next year. But I just think, again, that despite what would normally be very favorable differences in currencies that should be causing the dollar to rally. It has strong overhead resistance because any strength is allowing countries that have large exposure to dollars to lower that exposure.
Well, I mean, it's certainly going to, as you say, be a story that continues to unfold later on in this year and into next. I think you'd agree, especially considering the fact that the Fed has virtually guaranteed to promise to raise rates early by 2015. We'll see if that actually comes to pass, though. I think it'll be contingent upon the current economic environment. Another interesting story here that the commodities bear market, which occurred, of course, right around the time that gold peaked in 2011, there's a very strong correlation between the Eurozone economic trouble. They essentially entered a mini recession, if you will, and you'll notice that the Eurozone is emerging from what seems to have been a relatively minor recession. I'd like your thoughts about this, the correlation between the commodities market, precious metals, and the Eurozone. I mean, it's easy to forget the Eurozone now is considerably larger than the United States, at least population-wise. I mean, we're talking close to 500 million people, whereas we're at roughly 300 million folks. So it's a force to be reckoned with, and I'd like your thoughts, please.
I just don't see any real economic growth in Europe as a whole. There's certainly pockets that have rebounded from very, very low levels. There are a handful of countries that have managed to do okay on their own, but I don't see Europe as a whole gaining any real economic prowess. And one of the reasons is that many of them have still not been able to restructure the debt levels, both on both consumer levels as well as government levels. And wherever you look in the world now, you see that restraint. I mean, just look at Japan. I mean, Japan, if you want to talk about opening the spigots, and despite opening the spigots, just sees economic malaise can grow worse. And part of the things when you move from industrial bases, and let's not forget that not only was the United States, but any of the rest of the world was industrial farmer-based, and many went to service economies. A lot of that is a lot of needing of consumer spending. And the consumer, is particularly here in the U.S., but many other parts of the world, is basically strained out. As you know, you made a very good point earlier in this conversation, and it's a point that hasn't been spoken a lot. And it's just ironic that I kind of had a similar talk at a place where I recently spoke about how inflation has not really been the problem, but the lack of really increase in disposable income while normal costs of things have gone up. And the other thing that I wanted to add when you brought that up is there's so many things that are taxed now that weren't taxed before. I mean, everywhere we go and any type of bill we have, an electrical bill, gas bill, little permit things you have to get, even if you want to do work around your house, everywhere you go, we're paying some sort of fee that our families didn't pay 20 or 30 years ago. So I just believe there's a great economic strain on consumers worldwide and now even in China. So I just don't see how we can have strong growth worldwide. Eventually, something has to happen to these debt levels. They're going to have to be structured, reneged on, or monetized, or a combination of all three. And when that inevitably happens, those cycles don't take care of themselves in 6 weeks or 6 months. They take 6 years, sometimes a whole generation. So I just don't see how, you know, Europe, is it off the bottom from where it was a few years ago? No question about it. Is it going to be just an economic powerhouse anytime soon, and the Irish tiger is going to come back? And no, I just don't see how, because the debt levels constrain it.
You know, another interesting topic, China has been accelerating its push to have its citizens purchase as much physical gold as possible. China is a non-exporting nation. It's essentially illegal to send any gold of any size offshore. And they're now also not only the largest producer of gold, but now technically the largest importer of gold as well. They've made a big shift from prohibition on gold ownership to overtly encouraging ownership. I'd like your thoughts on just what might be the underlying plan here. Do you think that officials are laying the groundwork for a gold-backed currency?
I think that's a possibility. I think that and or that they see when an alternative world currency comes around, that eventually out of this mess, and it may be after my generation, I just turned 58, so it's still maybe 10, 20, or 30 years away, I do think they see that in order to bring back true economic stability worldwide, that some sort of return to a gold-backed currency, either in the new world reserve currency or in certain segments of currencies or in trade, will be needed. And to have a large holding of it and have its citizens holding that versus paper assets, say, in dollars, bodes well for them. So I think that's the main goal. I think they've also been the major accumulator of whatever gold is big terms over the last few years. They're not interested in driving the price higher. They're more than willing to soak up all the gold they can down at these levels. But it's another reason why I say, you know, a hogwash to the $1,000 or under price levels, because we know and we saw when gold retreated to 1200 and below, just, you know, the lining up and massive quantities of purchases. And also, I think the other thing that has long-term ramifications that doesn't get a lot of talk outside of the small amount of people in North America who look at gold on a daily basis, and that is that the exchanges that are trading gold now are being built and eventually will replace the CRIMEX, or what we still call the COMEX here. And I think once China becomes center place for gold trading, then I think they'll take off their gloves, they'll let it be known, because then they would love to see a greater price appreciation, because they will have a lot of the gold and it'd be well worth it to them and their citizens. So I fully suspect to continue, but I don't think they're ready to go and let the price free ride, but they are going to soak up whatever they can for as long as they can.
I'd also like your take on the silver market. You know, we've talked a lot about the yellow metal, less so on AG. It has incredible industrial applications. One would wonder why the nation has not, let's say, developed an affinity for silver, at least comparable to that of gold.
I just don't see the United States, because it's so controlled in the financial markets, and what the people who work on Wall Street say, they hate gold and they hate anything that comes with it, and silver obviously comes right next to it because it goes directly against what they live off of, financial assets. So I don't ever to see the general financial community and the talk and the talking heads and the journalists that, you know, follow them and make their living off of them ever given a positive spin for any length of time. That's why there's always such a negative tilt, even when things are going well for those metal prices. When you get outside the United States, a little bit in Canada, but particularly when you get over to the Far East and in India or what have you, silver is viewed in a very, very positive way. You're correct that there is industrial uses for it and continuing, but as much as some people seem to get mad when you say that, It still takes second place to gold, and I don't think that'll change. There'll be times when it can lead up and down the price, but I still think it's really a second-class citizen, so to speak, next to gold. And so you're just not going to see silver go up 25% and gold be flat and down, and vice versa as well. They are going to go in tandem. Sometimes one will lead the other, but I still think gold is viewed as the flagship of the precious metals, even though from a price and rarity level, platinum itself actually has a very interesting supply and demand scenario as well. But when people think metals, they think gold first.
Here's a alternative hypothesis. You know, we talked earlier about being taxed into oblivion, double, triple, quadruple taxed in many cases. Well, one fellow published an article noting that in his particular municipality and state, it requires 13 different licenses, tags, and related materials just to drive his automobile, everything from personal license plate to license tag, and the list just goes on to insurance, a driver's license. It was just an enormous list. What if we saw a scenario where the typical American just tossed up their hands and said, I can't make enough money, which I think is already occurring, no matter how hard I work, no matter how many second jobs I take, how we tighten our belts. The whole household, it seems like, has two or three jobs. You reach, I think, a tipping point, an interesting opportunity for, let's call it an under-the-table economy. We're seeing this explode in places like Greece, which incidentally has the largest market right now in the world. But it's not just Greece, though. It's actually in the United States, 7% of transactions occur under the table. And Central America and other areas where the currency and the government regulations are simply out of control. The system is failing. And so is that not a scenario where having a few bags of, let's say, 90% silver dimes might not come in handy to make transactions at your local farmer's market, curbside market, or with your neighbors?
My argument on that is that there's no question that what you said is happening in certain places. But my argument has always been, and it won't change, that if the day comes when the only way I can secure a loaf of bread or something to drink or to put a few petrols of gas into my car by using gold or silver coins, since the vast majority will have not had them by the time that comes, whatever I had will be much in danger and not likely to be held onto, because the masses who don't have it but see that I have it will do all they can to take it from me. So I just don't believe it's going to, if we ever do get to such a point in time when that is the only way that life will go on, the rorting of crowds and the coming together of the mobs to take from the few that have it will overwhelm even those that were smart enough to put it away. I do want to comment about what you said in the onset of that question, and that was how people becoming more and more frustrated and the inability to feel that they can get ahead. There is a great movement in the United States of a sense of it's better to get on the wagon than be the person that's still trying to pull the wagon. And that is the entitlement issue. In fact, I just issued the second edition of my book, and in the last chapter, that's the biggest fear that I feel that America is facing. And that is the battle that's going to take place over entitlements. And I really believe America is coming to the point where people, some have decided that they'd rather vote for a living than work for a living. And the problem with entitlements is very simple. You can see it as early in childhood. Once people are given something and they feel it's theirs and they're deserving of it, not only do they feel they're entitled to it, but they're not going to give it up. They're going to do everything they can to keep it. So the big battle that may come, and if it gets as bloody as you said, to the point where you need silver or gold to even get the simplest thing, then of course I believe what I said earlier will happen. But I do believe the next big battle in the U.S. is not going to be a war of the worlds, meaning some war with Russia and all, but it's going to be a class age war here in the United States. And it's not necessarily going to be fought with pitchforks and knives and guns, but it's going to be fought politically. And what's interesting about that is that the single biggest, largest voting bloc in the United States is the 65 and over group, and they control 80% of what's left of the wealth in the United States. And so we're going to have young people who may be working two jobs and seeing that, like you said, taxes going up to the point where they can't go anymore. And part of the reason is because that's money's being used to pay some poor 80-year-old person to get a $100 pill a day so they can stay alive. Now there, I see a really ugly battle taking form, and that's be something that I think is something America is not anywhere prepared for, and it ain't as far off as many some think it will be.
Something that I've discussed somewhat with another fellow who's well known for his demographic work, and that's Harry S. Dent Jr. here on the show many times. And you're right. The baby boomer generation, and I think I'm close on this, from 1946 to 1964, it is retiring to the tune of 500,000 baby boomers a month. The number seems impossible, but it really is 6 million a year. But I'm hopeful that the fact that they're retiring might open up enough employment opportunities to those of us who are paying these enormous taxes and reaping virtually zero benefits. I'm hopeful that this offset in baby boomer jobs might open up enough employment opportunities for the younger group. If not, you're right, there will be a demographic clash in this country.
Well, there's one fly in the ointment to that, and it is a good hope to have. And the fly in the ointment takes us to yet another of the battles that are taking place in America as we speak, and that's the immigration battle. and there is an argument to take away that benefit that you spoke, that there'll be such an onslaught, and has been, of people coming into the country, that whatever we would have gained by hopefully the seniors being able to retire, which is also being called into question now, and many studies now are coming out showing that seniors are going to have to back off maybe as much 5, 7, or 10 more years of work than they expected before they could even retire. But even if that, what you said is true, was to happen, there's a feeling also that whatever jobs might have come available, A, there'll be an onslaught of new population that can take or impact those jobs that wouldn't have otherwise. And two, the quality of jobs now in America, because we switched to the type of service economy we are, that the type of higher paying jobs or the upper middle class, as you said before, that's being basically destroyed, are not anymore being primarily in the U.S. They've moved abroad. So there's just a whole wealth of negative things that, while it doesn't appear the U.S. stock market seems focused on at this point, because they're so hooked on one drug called the Fed, and they believe as long as that drug is easily supplied, they can't get hurt. But at the end of the day, there's a long, long increasing list of fundamentals that have just gotten to the point that all of them, or just a handful of them being overwhelming, will break the straw, you know, the camel's back. And unfortunately, I guess the best way to sum this up is, I truly believe this, and it's sad as only the parent of one child of 21, I believe her generation and the generation to come will be the first generations in the U.S. history that will be less off, not better off, than the previous generation.
You raised some great points there, and if my child were a bit older, maybe 10, 15 more years, I would be recommending the compromise between our two viewpoints and the panacea for what's going to be coming down the economic pike, I think, in the next few decades. I would recommend get into the healthcare field. You don't have to be a doctor, you don't have to be a registered nurse, because this huge number, tens of millions of retiring baby boomers, will need an enormous amount of care because of our higher living standard, better pharmaceuticals, greater access to higher quality foods and organic foods, and in greater knowledge level via the internet and other communication sources. These folks will be living much longer. Instead of 65, 75, we're going to be looking at many millions of people living into their 80s and even their 90s and beyond. And they will require a tremendous amount of services. So that will be the booming place, I think, of the next few decades. To get back on track, I wanted to talk about Jeremy Grantham. Arguably one of the best analysts in the industry, called the stock market bubble. He called the housing bubble. He's saying that there's absolutely no indication that the Fed's efforts since 2008 to boost the economy will have any lasting impact within GDP or economic growth. Sure, they've put off the banking crisis, but it will absolutely act as a damper on economic growth in the future. You travel back to the 1980s, you notice that our debt level to GDP was only about 1.3 times. Fast forward to today, it's 3.3 times our national output. And that this essentially will act as an unbelievable weight holding down our economic growth in the future.
Well, I think it goes back to when QE1 was sold to us on the back of this, and people seem to have forgotten. When Obama came into the administration, we had a world financial crisis, and QE1 was created with the express purpose that we would get this money into the system, it would go into building roads and infrastructure and all the things, and things would get better. And the problem was that the money didn't flow that way. It flowed mostly to Wall Street. It didn't get to Main Street. And then let's remember that the whole idea of Bernanke's argument from the very beginning was that if he could raise the value of financial assets, given where they had fallen to, that would make people wealthier and get a wealth effect. I'm sure you remember that talk. And what that would simply mean is, oh, wow, look, honey, our IRAs are up, our stock portfolio's up. I think we can buy that new car or the new washing machine or take that trip, et cetera, et cetera. And that would just feed on itself, and that's how the economy would rebound, and that's why QE was done for. Well, lo and behold, that didn't happen. In fact, studies out most recently, despite the stock market and a five-year bull market, over half the Americans trust the markets even less now than before. And so even though some people have seen gains, they're not spending their gains. And that's what Japan has faced for 20-something years. Japan has not been able to get its consumers to spend a lot. They became older. The older generation just doesn't like to spend as the younger generation does. And that's been the big problem. So the wealth effect played a role only to a very limited at the top end, or what we like to call the 1%. It allowed the banks to return to profitability faster than they otherwise. But outside of that, it's really not have any economic growth. And what doesn't get discussed, and I guess it's because what state you're in, whether or not people talk about it a lot, but as bad as the federal debt level has come, one of the biggest untalked about relative to the debt talk is how bad unfunded pension levels have come on state levels and city levels. It's not just Detroit or Camden, New Jersey, but a whole host of cities and states that are facing very, very difficult abilities to fund liabilities that they have or expected to have. And although the governor here, Christie, managed to restructure what was really a giveaway type of pension where people could work for as little as 12 years and then receive health and other benefits for a lifetime, there's still enormous inadequacies in many, many state and city levels. And when you combine that with the consumer level debt and the federal debt, it's just a chokehold. All the Fed has done is forestall the inevitable. And really, I think I would argue made the inevitable going to be a lot worse than it would have been, that if they just let things go in 2008 and we might have had a real big fall and we might have been in a depression-like state for 5 or 10 years, but we would already be coming out of it now. But instead, the price that's going to be paid is even much greater now than it would have been 5 years ago. So I really think to surmise everything up is, yes, we've forestalled and we've so-called prevented a lot bad things, but all the things that were there to hurt us are still there, and many more have joined them. So what day we pay for it, I don't know, but that day of reckoning is coming.
Started off your comment with the trouble in the banking sector, and the Federal Reserve performed stress tests, I'm sure you remember last week, sent some reverberations, I think, throughout the economy and the markets. I mean, we saw Citigroup shares plunge 5% in one day. This annual checkup is required for banks and institutions with more than $50 billion in assets. And from what I've seen, though, it just doesn't look as though the banking system is prepared to withstand another 2008-2009 type credit crisis. 26 banks participated in the stress test, and they did receive the go-ahead for dividend payouts and repurchases. But I don't think that really tells us all that much. I mean, we already knew that. I mean, the markets are already aware of that. Just as our general equities markets recording new highs, we're starting to see the financial sector, though, come under pressure. It tends to be a precursor or a leader in the markets.
I think we've seen some strain there, but I do obviously they are still in a much better shape than they were just 4 or 5 years ago. And while I do believe that troubles are going to be very severe and for a much longer generation, I don't think it's going to be a collapse type of environment. I think it'll be a rollover environment. Things will get bad again. What's gotten away from people, and I'm even surprised in the bearish camp, or has not taken hold in this, and I guess I only see it because of the businesses that I'm involved out here. When you talk in the business community, whether a small pop-and-mom store, really up to mid-sized corporations, and I don't have a lot of dealings with Fortune 500, but I do have a lot of dealings with Fortune 1000 and companies that do anywhere from $5 million to a couple $100 million in sales. And what they'll tell you is there's been zero, and it goes past even this administration, back a couple administrations, but there's been zero progress in Washington on any matters that help and enhance businesses. Businesses are more constrained today for a variety of reasons, whether it's health care, regulation, environmental, labor practices, whatever you name, anybody has been in business will tell you it's tougher to be in business today, despite all the innovations that technology has brought, than it was 20, 30, or 40 years ago. And so Washington has got kind of like an escape goat and really has put on the Federal Reserve a responsibility it should never have to begin with, and that's fiscal management and laws and regulations. And we really come down to, well, if the Fed can just keep this and keep the market going, we'll somehow do well, when in fact it's so difficult to work in the business world in America now than any other period of time in recent history. And I think that's a subject that doesn't get spoken about. But if you go out there and you visit and you get past the CEOs that are showing up on financial talk shows who are public companies and are always going to paint a bright picture, and instead talk to CEOs of small to mid-sized companies who don't have the luxury of the public market or the corporate debt market, and ask them how they're doing, they'll tell you it's next to impossible to get any real growth at this point. They're all more in a survival mode than anything else.
My work is showing, for instance, Citigroup and several others in that industry. To me, one of the best shorts right now, although I am not an advocate, I'm not pushing it as a sale. In fact, I don't short stocks. I can't remember the last time I did. But Citigroup, I think, is one of the best shorts I've seen in years. I mean, their earnings, their return on equity, the return on investment is half that of the industry average. We're seeing a deceleration in most of their metrics and financials. Technically, it's one of the best setups for a sell. This is not a recommendation. I expect to see sub 40 levels in Citigroup in the next few weeks to months, and certainly by next year. I'm mentioning that not to get people all excited about selling the company. I much prefer the long side, because everyone knows that's where the money is. The best you can do is 50 to 100% on the short side. The long side, you can make thousands of percent. But the reason I mention that is I don't want to see people take a big haircut in this. That's what I'm seeing. Every single chart, even to Goldman Sachs, you know, one of the leaders in the industry, looks very vulnerable to sell off here. Please end this dialogue today with your outlook on the gold miners. This is a favorite area of yours. It is a favorite of our listeners today. And I would be remiss if I didn't at least pose that question to you before we wrap up.
I think the good news is it's clear and evident that the worst is behind us, particularly the higher we go up the food chain. I'm not convinced yet that the junior resource market as a group as a whole, and I suspect that, and we're starting to see it now, some really companies that try to survive all through this but had no choice but to throw in the towel, which unfortunately for them is bad, but will be good for the vast majority that are going to more than survive. I still believe that the best sweet spot in this market, until such time we get above 1550, which I think will be a challenge but can still be done in this calendar year, is the expanding mid-sized producer who, either through organic growth or acquisition, because so many things are very, very attractively priced right now, can really increase its annual production in any particular metal it may specialize in. I think those are the most attractively priced right now type of companies. So from mid-sized producers to major producers, we have to be overweighted there versus the junior segment market, where people are startups and where it's still fairly difficult to raise capital and also to get any pop, so to speak, even when you do have good news.
Any last comments here or contact information for the listeners, please?
Well, I would just welcome people. They can read my commentaries totally free of charge at Money Talks, one word, moneytalks.net, under Peter's content.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. I believe there is a direct relationship between the continued and growing tension between the United States and Russia and the accelerated yet officially unacknowledged collapse of the dollar as it loosens its grip on the global financial system as the currency of choice. When I was a kid, I was a big fan of Hogan's Heroes. One of Colonel Hogan's regular strategies was to create a diversion. I remember him saying, if your toe is aching and someone hits you on the head with a hammer, you soon forget about your toe. The same is true in geopolitics and currency wars. The dollar is a big toe. Not only have we stubbed that toe, we've broken it. But that's a state secret. Officially, we can't let anybody know the reason we're off balance financially and can't walk a straight line. We're doing everything within our power to cover that up. With economic misinformation, a loosening of credit standards, and a return to the very practices that caused the economic crisis in the first place. And now, as foundational cracks appear like fault lines in an earthquake, we are about to resort to military conflict. At least the illusion and near-death experience of military conflict. Because when all else fails, we go to war. Or at least create the impression we are willing to do so. Case in point. The Ukraine has just agreed to host NATO war games. Ukraine's parliament approved a series of joint military exercises with NATO countries that would put U.S. troops in direct proximity to Russian forces in the recently annexed Crimea Peninsula. Russia has reportedly repositioned about 700 soldiers further back from the border in what was perceived as a small sign that the situation is becoming less tense. Regardless, though, war games are scheduled for later this summer on the border with Russia. I believe these war games have less to do with military reasons and more to do with potential shifts in the economy. They are preparations for potential economic cracks that cannot be manipulated or printed away. War games are games in name only. That is, if we want them to be. If the economy nosedives, we're going to war. We'll find or invent an excuse. Our toe is aching, and somebody is going to get hit on the head with a hammer. The question is who, when, how hard, and will it really do anything to solve the larger problem? I say not. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.